Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I want to say before we begin that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, you can go to www.umm.edu/heart. Or just go to our webpage and connect to it right there. In this hour of the show, we're going to talk about technology and privacy, but we're going to talk and begin to talk about what happened in Iran with two men who are representing Iranian journalist Issa Sakhariz. And if I said that name wrong, they'll correct me. Sakhariz, excuse me. In his suit against Nokia Siemens Networks for allegedly releasing information to the Iranian government that let them use his cell phone for surveillance. Now, we are joined by Ali Harishi, who was on this show before when he was working with the Iranian students and others who were protesting over the election, and that's how we met him. He's now a lawyer in his own right and founding partner of Mawad and Harishi LLP. We're also joined by Edward Mawad, who is the other founding partner and also represents in this case. And Ali and Edward, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have on the phone with us Zainab Tufekci, who has joined us before. She is assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, and author of the blog technosociology.org. And it's a pleasure to have you back with us, Zainab. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Sean Gallagher is with us, a freelance technology journalist and technology editor of NBC's Digital's Tech Goes Strong. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, Mark.
I would say that Sean has been here since the very early beginnings of the show, 17 years ago or so, when he's been coming on Talk Back Technology. It's good to see him again. And he looks good because he's lost 50 pounds. The man looks much different. It's good to see you. Number here is 410-319-8888. And in a more serious note here, Ali and Edward, let's talk about this case. And Ali, you sent me this email, so describe the case and what happened here.
So this is the case against Nokia Siemens Networks. They are a European company who sold sophisticated intercepting devices for mobile and telecommunication to Iran in 2008. At the time that they were dealing with Iran in 2008, they had knowledge about the way that Iran is going to use these intercepting devices, which is going to use against the dissent and basically in crackdown or in violation of citizens' privacy rights. But they went forward and sold this equipment to Iran. And in aftermath of the election in 2009, Iranian government broadly used this technology in arresting protesters and all the basically whoever was against the that election and claiming that the election was rigged. And my client was arrested 10 days after the election, after he wrote a very famous article and claiming that it was a coup, not an election. And after he was in hiding in northern Iran when they intercept his phone conversations and basically located him, arrested him. At the time of the arrest, they beat him for hours. They broke his ribs, arms, and other fractions. And instead of taking him to hospital, they drove him to Tehran, which is 250 miles distance. And then they took him. Actually, the jail did not accept him because they said it may be internal bleeding. So they sent him to hospital, and they took some x-rays. They show all the fractions, but still they returned him to the hospital. And he stayed in solitary confinement for about 80 days. And still, after 14 months, he's in jail without a conviction.
And let me bring your partner Edward Mawad into this conversation. So how does this relate to Nokia Siemens, and why are you suing that company?
Well, and just to give a little bit of background, United States law permits aliens or Americans to sue in tort when there is a violation of Treaty of the United States or the Law of Nations. This is based on the Alien Tort Statute. since the sale of this equipment was done with the full knowledge that the use could be to harm others, having the basic knowledge about Iran and human rights abuses in Iran, United States law is probably the only venue in the world that permits aliens or foreigners who are harmed to sue for damages.
So now, but what is it that Nokia is supposed to have done? We know who they are in terms of the mass market and making cell phones and manufacturing cell phones that many people use, but what is it they are alleged to have done?
They sold to Iran spying centers, meaning that they were the Iranian government is not just only able to listen to small phone conversation, but they're also able to track the cell phone use, data, network activities, and basically they gave them a network-wide or a country-wide monitoring center or a spying center. This, in essence, aided the notorious regime in committing further human rights violations and hence liability.
Now, we'll talk later in this program about how many major companies are working with people across the country, across the world, in ways that we find objectionable. But the Nokia, in response, is saying, "Well, look, yes, we did set up these centers. We're helping police systems across the world monitor these systems to stop drug trafficking, disrupt international trade of children and women, and the like. But when we realized what was going on in Iran, we stopped." And they say they stopped well before that Issa Saharkiz was arrested. So, can you respond?
The point is, the response is that first they cannot remove their responsibility since they are not going to sell again to Iran. When they sold, they assumed the responsibility. When they ignored their knowledge about the method of use of those equipment. Second thing is they are not dismantling or they are not stopping the service that they whatever they sold to Iran. They are not going to sell a new product. Still, those equipments are working, maintaining, and that contract, they never said that they are not going to honor that contract. They are still, honoring the sales that they did on 2008. So they are still in process of aiding that, in our belief, illegal intercepting devices.
I wonder, Zainab, let me ask you to join this for a moment before we move on to other parts of our conversation. But I know that you've been following a lot about what goes on in this arena.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, A, your thoughts on the specific case you're listening to now, but B, how much more of this went on in Iran and other places of people being caught and intercepted because of the use of modern technology.
I think if I might answer your question, I see where you're going with this. Communication, especially from the developed world, has really brought tremendous progress to developing countries, including Iran and Africa and Southeast Asia. That's one thing when there is when you provide that population that has been underserved with communication devices. It is entirely a different matter when you provide their government with methods of spying so they could quell and squash dissent. I hope that answered your question as far as why, when you sell communication devices, they might be good for human rights because they allowed people to broadcast some of the things or the abuses that happened in Iran. But on the other hand, the technology that Nokia Siemens provided to Iran enabled the government to track some of these offenders and arrest them, torture them, subject them to multitude of violations of human rights, of their human rights.
And Zainab, I guess, go ahead, Zainab.
Yeah, this actually is a very interesting case in terms of what happened to this person, and I think is demonstrative of both the incredibly empowering impact of technology, but it also empowers governments for this kind of increased surveillance. Because on the one hand, citizens can use these technologies to communicate with each other and organize in ways that would have been very difficult before the days of such tools. I mean, we have, going back to the Tiananmen protests in China, which were helped by the fax, you know, being used to organize, we see this again and again. But on the other hand, governments can, and it's not just governments in the developing world. We know that in countries, even ours, this kind of surveillance capacity has been used by governments to locate potential dissidents and to sometimes suppress the very kind of democratic activism we see. So I think it's not an unalloyed good, and it's kind of a question of whether the citizen empowerment that's brought about by these technologies will, in the long run, be stronger than the surveillance and control capacity, the increased capacity that the governments gain from these technologies. And I don't think we have the answer yet. It's an evolving, a very dynamic situation, and in maybe 50 years, 30 years, historians will look back and say, oh, it was obvious, but at the moment, it is not.
So I wonder if very quickly, before we move and introduce our other guest and bring Sean Gallagher in the conversation and begin to talk about the issues that are affecting the United States right now with all this and the issues of privacy and the Fourth Amendment and technology. Do any of the three of you know about any other cases in Iran, less specifically Iran, but other places where, you know, during the crisis, Ali, you were in touch with people in Iran, and we used Facebook a lot to stay in touch with people in Iran who friended us here on the show, and I kept wondering all that time if the safety of those other people who use Facebook and use other technologies and how many people might have been caught, arrested, tortured, or even killed because of that technology, or the use of that technology.
There are reports, many reports, about very generic methods using technology in arresting people. For example, they were using certain text messages. So whoever, because these capabilities that they sold to Iran has the option that you can change the content of the message. So what they were doing is were sending a mass text, and based on that text, whoever responded, they were arrested. Or whoever, for example, it was an appointment for a meeting, and they changed the time or place or location of that meeting, and whoever showed up, they got arrested. About the web logs, and many of the web logs, many web blogger whoever post online YouTube or posted certain material online, they got arrested. And it was a very well-known fact in the society that telecommunication devices and internet is closely monitored. Even those who made international phone calls, they were right after, 2 minutes after the phone conversation, they got their phone from authorities that, we know that you talked to the United States, be careful what you are saying, and they start threatening people who are in communication or in connection with the Western world.
Now, what were you trying to say, Zina, before we move ahead?
Yeah, what I'm saying is it's instructive to compare to the case of Burma, where there was the, 2007, the Saffron Revolution. We also saw a lot of images. But we no longer even know about it, or none of us are talking about it, because the Burmese government, well, the Myanmar junta, as they call themselves, has been able to completely shut down media communication. Whereas in the case of Iran, even though they are able to, bring down this sort of the arm of the state, we're still hearing about them. And maybe without these technologies, we would not know about what was going on at all. So I just want to sort of emphasize that. Yes, they're taking risks, but these people are taking risks because they must know what they're doing. And to them, it is more important to try to free their country. And those the freeing of their country, the activities come with the risks. Whereas in the case of Burma, it seems like people don't even have that choice. The place is just in shutdown. We don't hear anything. Who knows what they've done there?
Yeah. And on that, we very quick, because we really have to take a break and go to our next subject. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. If I may say just last minute here, it's quite one thing to sell this technology to Germany. It's quite another to sell it to a government like Iran or the former, or Syria or Iraq or any of the notorious regimes. I think that what we're asking for, in addition to all the, to bring this to light, but also we're asking that Nokia Siemens stop selling this sort of technology to other countries that are known for human rights violations.
Ali Harishi and Edward Morwad, I want to thank you both for being with us from Harishi and Morwad, law firm that's taking on the case of Issa Saharkis, and we'll have more information about that and links to other articles about that on our website. And we want to talk with you more and keep abreast of this case. I want to thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And when we return, Zeynep will stay with us, and Sean Gallagher's in the studio, Jay Stenney from the ACLU is on by phone, and we'll talk about this country and technology and privacy and more. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. I want to tell you that attention to all jazz vocalists and musicians, you're invited to a historic photo shoot, A Great Day in Baltimore, Monday, September 13th, 9 a.m. at War Memorial Plaza. The photo shoot will bring together local and regional musicians in Baltimore's rich musical history, past and present, to support jazz in the city. Proceeds from the photograph will benefit the UB Blake Cultural Center's jazz workshop programs. You can call 443-204-1730. That's 443-204-1730. We're going to see how what we've talked about fits into this country and issues of privacy and the Fourth Amendment and more. We're joined in studio by Sean Gallagher, who's a freelance technology journalist and technology editor of NBC's Digital's Tech Go Strong. Zeynep Tufekci remains with us. She is an assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology and author of the blog technologysociology.org. And by phone as well, we are joined by Jay Stanley, who is Senior Program Analyst for the ACLUs, at the American Civil Liberties Union's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Program. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be here.
Hello.
And Jay, as you were listening in the other conversation that we were having, other folks may be listening as well, but as you were listening to that program, I wonder how you reflect on that in terms of our own issues about privacy and technology in this country, because you at the ACLU have been raising this flag a lot recently, and I've seen it in your emails, at least in the emails I've been reading.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting issue. I mean, I can't comment on that Nokia case.
No, I didn't expect you to.
But I think that it does raise a lot of questions. Number one is the intersection between the private sector and the government, and there is a lot of money to be made selling not only, hardware that's used for collecting information and tracking people, but also collecting and buying and selling and trading data about people. And that's something that the private sector has in recent, decade or two, has really realized is worth cold, hard cash. You know, as much information, as many details about the lives of their customers as they can gather, the more they can monetize that for advertising purposes and other purposes, and just by outright selling it. And at the same time, the government has become very interested in tapping into a lot of that information that's gathered by the private sector. So we see a dovetailing of the private sector and the government in many ways. And also, I think that the question that Zeynep raised, which is, is technology going to, in what ways is technology going to make our lives better, in which ways is it going to increase the power that powerful institutions have over us? And I think there's no question that so far the technology and information revolutions that we're all living through and enjoying have made our lives a lot better. But at the same time, they do have a potential dark side, which is that they generate a lot of information about very small details about our every action and purchase and movement and sometimes even thought. And if we're not careful and if we're not wise about how we construct the public policies around all these new technologies, we may find ourselves waking up in an America that we scarcely recognize in terms of our privacy rights. And that's something, I think that, if technology is just left into the wild, wild west in some ways and we don't take care to keep the checks and balances on government and the private sector, too, we don't keep those up to date, that that it may, in fact, have a net effect of tilting the balance of power away from ordinary people and towards, large institutions like the government and big companies.
And a month ago, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about it was entitled The Web's New Goldmine, Your Secrets. And it really went through how companies in this country now can aggregate data so that, you know, when we talk about how do you support the Internet and how you're going to, Internet's going to pay for itself, well, there's billions of dollars. I think if I read correctly, a $38 billion industry right now in America of selling aggregated data, maybe something more than aggregated data in some cases, so you can be sold to. So people know what you're doing, what you like, what you don't like, and that means people are literally taking information of what you put on Facebook, taking information on when you buy something from, let's say, eBay, taking information when you Google something to do some research, and setting a form about what you think, who you are, what you like and don't like, to sell it back to you. And so this technology that we think is ours is really an invasive tool for others, Sean Gallagher.
Well, that's Facebook's business model. Facebook makes money off of learning everything they can about you and then using that first to sell
ads. I'm looking
ads.
At it right now because we're using it for the show. I'm looking at people who have written in.
If you look at it, you see that it's targeting ads to you based on what you've said you like. And then it's also collecting all that data about what you like and what you dislike in an effort to build a preference search engine. They're in the process of trying to really create something in which people can have their tastes collected, and you can search those and find people. As a retailer, for example, you can use Facebook to target those people to get them into groups. There's a very healthy industry in social network marketing right now in terms of being able to go out and grab people's personal information that's made public by those people and use it to drive marketing. And companies play a game of trying to grab each other's customers based on who, let's say you go on Facebook and say, I like Coke. Well, Pepsi would have somebody on Facebook looking for people who say they like Coke, looking at the network of people that's around those people and how much they influence those other people. So I would say, Mark, you've got a lot of influence over a lot of people. And you like Coke. I want to turn you into a Pepsi drinker. And
never happened.
And so they would go, after people like that and use social networks to influence other people. But they also can collect all this information about you. And now Facebook has location-based information that they collect, Facebook Places. I know the ACLU San Francisco office had something to say about the privacy issues around that. There's a lot of ways that location-based data is getting used by marketers now. Then they can identify you as a person and where you are and use that as a marketing tool and use that information to aggregate information about your behavior. So there are applications out there now that give you bonus points for being in a store.
Well, I want to add something here because I think a lot of people
think
who cares if somebody markets Pepsi or Coke to me, which is kind of true. I don't terribly care either. But the issue here isn't just being used for that kind of, you know, marketing that we see in all sorts of other ways. What's happening is that we are doing things in a medium where we mean to do something, which is socialize with our friends, but that is being collected and aggregated with all sorts of other data in ways that would not have been possible to do before. So this information can then be matched to your mortgage and any criminal records you might or might not have, and things that you thought were private but are kind of done in a way that these data aggregators can collect. I mean, the comparison I make is to this is if you were in a rented dwelling, right? If you're renting a condo or a house, you have a reasonable expectation that, you know, somebody's not recording everything you say in your house to then try to sell you stuff or to try to prosecute you or try to – you have an expectation there. And now what's happening is we've moved our socializing to this new medium where the laws have not come with us. The same kind of understanding and laws that would protect us have not come with us. And just because nobody's setting the laws in a way that protect the consumer doesn't mean that nothing is happening. What's happening is exactly what Sean and Jay have described. And it's removed any kind of sense that you can expect what you do not to be matched with everything you've ever done in a way that can then be used to either manipulate you or to prosecute you perhaps or to try to convince you of this and that, and you don't know that this is out there about you in an aggregate form. So it's a really imbalanced relationship, and I find this quite worrisome. We're moving into a surveillance society step by step. There's surveillance everywhere around us, and we sort of hear of this and that, and there's a little bit of consumer unrest over a little bit and a little bit that. But it just kind of goes under, and then we see one big step. Now we have our phones tracking us all the time, and next, you know, next. So it's a very important issue.
So before you jump in, I'm going to get Jane here as well. I'm going to get our listeners to join us at 410-319-8888. And your thoughts on this, and when you hear this kind of conversation, know that your data is being aggregated, know you can be followed by what's happening in your cell phone. What are your thoughts about that? We all use this technology. Well, most of us do. Do you use your cell phone every day? Do you use Facebook every day? Do you trade pictures on the internet with friends? All that can be seen. What do you think about that, and what do you think can or should be done? 410-319-8888. We're joined by, you just heard, Zeynep Tufekci, who is a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and whose blog... author of the blog,
Sociology.
Sociology. I was just shortening for a quick introduction in
there
this midterm. technology, sociology.org. Sean Gallagher, who is a freelance technology journalist, and Jay Stanley with the ACLU's Free Speech, Privacy, and Technology Program. 410-319-8888 is the number here. A lot of people have written in on our Facebook page, and we'll see what they had to say as well. But in what we just heard from the two of you, So the question is, as Tracy Gosson, who wrote in earlier, who actually sent me the article on Facebook from the Wall Street Journal, which is how I read it, she said to make sure you read this series before you do the show. But then she just said it's an issue, if I can get her exact quote here, and ask this question of the two of you, starting with the three of you, starting with Jay. She said, after the series, I turn on in private filtering whenever I use IE. Go in there and you won't believe all this stuff that's been loaded onto your computer. This is a very difficult situation that we face in society right now, but there's really little we can do about it. There are no easy answers, she writes. Jay Stanley, let me let you tackle that first and go over to Sean and Zeynep.
Well, it's true. I mean, there is a lot that can be done as an individual, but ultimately this is a social problem that we as a society and, you know, as a world in some ways, we need to decide where we're going to draw the lines. I mean, the defenders of this kind of, you know, giant surveillance machinery that's being built on the Internet for advertising purposes, defenders will say, well, you know, everything is free on the Internet, and that's supported by advertising, and it has to be efficient, and if you want free stuff on the Internet, you know, we're going to have to advertise to you. And that is true, but you know, Americans have values that are greater than advertising and economics. And, you know, previous generations, when the phone system was constructed, they decided that, you know, the phone company could not listen into your phone conversations and write down who you were calling and what you were talking about and then send you advertisements based on that. And the Internet equivalent shouldn't be allowed either. And that's basically what's being allowed just because nobody has taken any action to stop it. There haven't been regulations to draw a line around this area of commerce and say, you know what, we're not going to do business in that way. It violates our values as Americans.
Now, I want to highlight something here. A lot of people say, well, don't use it, right? Don't use it if you don't like it. And that is not realistic or fair because do we tell people not to use the phone? Because if you use the phone, you're giving the government and everybody the right, as you just said, to listen on. No, we say people have a right to use the phone. You cannot be an active participant of life in 21st century without these tools. So telling people, well, it's optional, just drop out, it's not okay. So I want to emphasize that.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, that said, there are things that can be done, such as regularly erasing your cookies, and there are things called flash cookies that can be erased, and that can help in terms of, you know, network advertising. And, of course, it's worth remembering that behind all of this private sector information gathering is the government, which, after the Patriot Act and 9/11, has more power than it's ever had without checks and balances, without judicial oversight, to swoop in and gather up your information from these private companies who may be holding it for advertising purposes. Who knows what the government's purposes are? They might find you suspicious because, you know, your name showed up on a watch list or what have you. We certainly know that a lot of crazy things have been happening on that front. So even if you have nothing to hide, you're not doing anything wrong, you feel like most of what you do on the internet is boring, and why would anybody possibly be interested in it? You could be mistaken for somebody else. Little details of your life could be used by powerful government parties or insurance companies or others against you. So this is something that does concern us all, and ultimately we need to put good regulations in place.
Sean, you want to comment before we open the phones and read some more Facebook messages here?
I just wanted to say that I always operate on the assumption that anything that I put online in any form can be posted someplace else or can be grabbed by someone else and used for something else. Any information I put online is vulnerable to being captured by someone. And yes, you can turn off cookies and things like that. You can go in and set up your privacy settings in Facebook to lock down who can see your information. But even your friends are a threat in that regard because they can just easily, you know, say something you said and or retweet on Twitter or whatever, republish your information and expose you that way. Or they may not have their privacy settings set properly and things that you say get exposed through them.
Exactly,
and
right, yeah, because you don't, it's not just you. With Facebook Places, for example, your friends have the ability to tag you in places saying, oh, I just saw Sean in this place. So it's not enough. If you want to turn your privacy settings carefully, your friends could expose you. This is very important.
And there are a generation of people who think that's fine because they really have grown up in this environment, the post-9/11 environment, where privacy is not as big a deal to them for some reason. Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook says that, you know, all of us boomers have to get over it, you know, that privacy is dead and we just need to deal with that. And Scott McNeely, the former CEO of Sun, said the same thing a number of years ago. He said that privacy is dead, get over it.
Well, I want to jump to this. There's comments here by Skip and Linda I want to read, and Keith, who is of the generation you're talking about, who says something similar on Facebook. I'm going to try to get to that and get these phone calls at 410-319-8888 as well. Let's go to Fran first. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Fran. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to reiterate what the young lady was talking about before about the privacy and how we get our information and how it's done. I had a kind of like a private situation where I contacted someone I hadn't seen in 30 years, years ago, and I contacted them, I think, through the internet. And someone in their family who doesn't like me sent me this nice, nasty letter saying, you are not allowed to, you know, blog us. You are not allowed to email us and text message and blah, 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 the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
And you cannot do the family and friends thing and all this thing. I took that letter to my lawyer, and he said that it was absolutely insane. It was totally out of the legal bounds. There was no courtroom in any state that would uphold that because no laws exist to do that. And he said I had nothing to worry about, and you know, and just throw it away. But basically, everything that she said is true, and what he said, you do have settings that you can put on there to put to private or whatever. And yes, your friends can give your information to somebody else, whether they know it or not. It's basically this: the internet is literally open to the world. You decide what you want the world to see about you that you're comfortable with, and that's, to me, how it is. And you really can't do too much about the other stuff. You know, you can just delete it. If you don't want an advertisement, don't open it up. Just delete it.
Thank you, Fran. I wanted to Jay, let me just jump in with you first and let you kind of wrestle with something you have, or other guests wrestle with it, and then read the Facebook and go back to the phones. I keep saying Facebook. Who's watching us now? But the issue is that the Fourth Amendment, which is supposed to guarantee our privacy, that was written in the 18th century, is part of the issue we're wrestling with here, and that all the laws we've created around privacy were written really in the 50s, 60s, 70s, before this technology took hold. And that's the place we are. So what is the beginning of the answer to how we wrestle this question legally, if it can be wrestled with?
Yeah, well, you make a good point. I mean, unfortunately, you know, our technology is moving so quickly that our laws really have not kept pace, and that includes the interpretations and the way that our Fourth Amendment has been interpreted by the Supreme Court and other courts. which have, you know, unfortunately not kept pace with the reality. There's a thing called a third-party doctrine that the Supreme Court invented in the 1970s, which says that if you share your information with any third party, you lose any Fourth Amendment protection in it. So, for example, if you all your financial information, you know, your bank has access to it, therefore the government can come in and take it, and you have no Fourth Amendment right to it. And that has big implications because, you know, when Thomas Jefferson was sitting in his study, all of his finances and all of his correspondence, and his medical life, all took place within his home. And now all that information is likely to sit on the servers of some international corporation, a third party, and yet, you know, we still need the same level of privacy for our persons.
So let me ask this question, Jen. I have to have this answer as well. So when the Fourth Amendment says that it's the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and papers and effects against unreasonable searches or seizures shall not be violated. I'm just stopping there for that part of the Fourth Amendment. Of course, the Fourth Amendment says anything about what you have on Facebook or what email conversations you had. But this is where the battle has to be in terms of interpretation and what this means in terms of new technology. That's what we haven't done yet, is wrestle with that.
Yeah, and the Fourth Amendment is an issue, and also our laws. Our electronic privacy laws were written in 1986, which was before the World Wide Web was even invented.
Right, or cell phones or any of the rest.
Yeah, and so the laws are very vague on, you know, can the government access your, you know, records of your location generated by your cell phone, and what's the standard for them to access your email and your Facebook messages and all of that is just undetermined because the technology is moving too quickly, and so we really need to bring that up to speed.
And Sean, then we'll go to Zainab.
I was just going to say that the defense that they're going to come up with that Facebook would use for this is that they're a publishing site, they are a blogging site, and so this is a First Amendment issue in their regard. That's how they'll look at it.
Well, yeah, and that is really not fair because when people go to Facebook to socialize with their friends, and I do research on this, and I do want to say it's not true that young people don't care about this at all. They do care about it. They're just kind of maybe a little more resigned, but it bothers them when they are, you know, exposed to the world in ways they don't want because it's fundamental to human dignity to have control. When you go to a Facebook profile of yours and, you know, interact with your friends, in your own mind, what you are doing is sitting in a room talking with a bunch of friends. That's it. And that's what the privacy standard should be based on, is what the function of that place is, not whether or not somebody could actually record it. I mean, I compare this to if your landlord was allowed to put all sorts of recording devices in your home just because, you know, he or she owned the walls, you were just renting, and are they allowed to do that? No, they're not, because we realize this is a space that is not for that function.
I agree with that 100%, and I think that Fran put it very well, which is that, you know, privacy does not necessarily mean that, you know, you keep everything secret about yourself. It means that you decide what you want the world to see.
Right.
And, of course, you have a free speech right to get on your Facebook page and say whatever you want, and, you know, a lot of people are happy to post naked pictures of themselves on the Internet. As long as they know what they're doing, that's fine. The problem comes in when you don't understand everything you do online is being tracked by these network advertisers or possibly by the government, or you don't. Or Facebook, companies like Facebook changes its privacy terms so often and in such complicated ways that you really don't know the extent to which you are exposing yourself.
And I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying what I think that their defense would be. And
yeah.
I'm not saying it's a good defense. And I would agree with you that Facebook has changed its privacy settings in ways that are intentional to expose people further. Each time they change their privacy settings, they've done something that makes it a little bit more confusing and opens up something else as being default to open to everyone. And they do that for a reason, because they think that the power of their network and their financial return is based upon everybody being as open as possible. And perhaps that's true, at least the second part.
Let me read a couple of things from Facebook here and encourage folks to call back at 410-319-8888. We'll get you right on the air as soon as you call in. And I'll read a couple of these in a row because they relate to one another. Robert Leverton wrote in, "It's a new day and a new age. It will be much more difficult in a digital/internet age to control our privacy. I believe this is a given. So what do we do? Live life with the understanding that we do live in very transparent lives. Live your life accordingly." Linda Shank, who could have been a guest on the show, will be next time, wrote in saying, "Facebook and other social networking sites aren't free. You are paying for it with the information about your life. Same with shopping at the grocery and saving a few cents when you swipe your bonus card. Personally, the quote-unquote benefits I feel get in exchange for this information is fine with me. I want 10 items for less money. I'd rather see ads that may actually be something I'm interested in. I don't have to click if I'm not. I want a website that will function better because they knew where I clicked. The other part of privacy online is something that I see many people not taking much personal responsibility for. That's the information they choose to share, even behind privacy settings. Consider professional, personal, or private. If it's private, don't put it online at all. Personal does not equal every real personal detail about your life. It can be a cocktail party safe info. There's no filter on people's gossip or screenshot. Your social network probably intersects with people who don't want to know that information, so don't take the risk and put it out there. Easy rule, if you wouldn't put up a sign on a street corner, don't post, or even under your quote-unquote private profile. That's not Big Brother. That's your choice. What do you think of that?
Well, that's very similar to a story I wrote a while ago on Tech Goes Strong, and talking about what's appropriate for you to post on Facebook or Twitter. And the idea is, remember, that it's like big cocktail party. What would you say in a cocktail party where you were with a lot of people where it could leave the room? And that's not saying that that's an ideal environment. That's just a state of the way things are. If you say something in Facebook, you have to be prepared for it to be public knowledge.
And I want to object to this idea here that Linda Shank has, I think, that it's sort of an optional service. Again, it's treating it like it's just saving a few cents, whereas in the case of Facebook, it's for young adults, for example. It's an alternative-less place to be social. I mean, you cannot tell, especially like college students I study, you cannot tell them, do not be on Facebook. We might as well tell them to walk around with a bag on their heads. It is not to be social, to participate in social life, should be seen as a fundamental right. And I don't really get this idea where if I participate in the world in 21st century, which includes using the internet as a basic right, therefore I have given up my right to privacy.
Let me probe that a minute. I mean, let me answer through this question from what you just said and what Linda just wrote in. And Jackie and Towson, let me ask this one question. We're going to come right to your call. So the question is, one of the things you just said, Zeynep, is that it's our right. Using the internet is a right. But is it? I mean, the question is, there are two different things. Is there a difference between people putting out there, every time I open up Facebook and you see people telling you like what they ate, when they went to the lavatory, who cares? I mean, why is it all up? Why do you put all your personal information up in the first place, A? But B, is there a difference between that and putting you out there when you know anyone can hack it? Our Facebook page was hacked just the other day. We had to change things to take it back. But so it's vulnerable. Is there a difference between that and issues that you're trying to raise, Jay Stanley, about issues of guaranteeing our privacy? This is a very difficult thing to cut through, because technology doesn't make it easy for us to redefine this. I'd like to get all three of your thoughts on that, starting with Jay, and Zeynep, if you can jump in and take on what you hear, and then Sean.
I mean, look, Facebook is a private company, and they've set up a private website, and they can set whatever terms for publicity that they want. If they want to say that basically we're creating a forum where people create public web pages, which is what they seem to have been moving towards in some ways, they certainly are within their rights to do that. The problem comes when there's a disconnect between the privacy that people think they have and what they actually have. And that disconnect has come about because I think the way Facebook works is it confuses people's intuitions about privacy. We had a case come to our attention where a fellow in one state created a pot growing operation in his basement. And he was so proud of it, he put pictures on his Facebook page. And one of his friends was a cop in Florida who called a friend of his up north, and the guy got arrested. I mean, that's just dumb. But it also, it's an indication that people don't understand. And I think as Sean said, Facebook's intentionally inculcating that. And one of your Facebook people said, if it's private, don't put it online. Well, I mean, aside from Facebook, this is bigger than just Facebook. If people cannot put private things online, that greatly reduces the usefulness of the internet. Companies trade you know, information internally that they don't want exposed. Individuals go online to get advice about medical conditions or psychological conditions that they might have, or bad experiences, abuse. There's a tremendous amount of things that happen online that are private, and that the Internet is useful because they allow people to be private. And if we let that be destroyed, and there's some talk, you know, in the cybersecurity world about creating a driver's license for the Internet so that we know who everybody is in case you're a hacker, and basically ending the possibility of anonymity online, which is a very frightening concept because the Internet is, as a practical matter, where people today exercise their right to free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Stand on the corner and yell, and very few people will hear you, and even fewer will listen to you. But, you know, you can set up a blog, and based on the content of what you say and how compelling it is, you may find an audience of millions of people. It's really a wonderful thing, and we need to preserve our privacy values in this wonderful new arena in order to keep it useful. Because when people know that or don't have confidence that the things they're saying are only being heard by the people they think that are hearing them, then they will use other techniques, and it becomes economically less efficient, and it just becomes harder to exercise your rights.
Is that it?
Yeah, well, I am going to say that it's not... We seem to be totally on the same page in terms of the Fourth Amendment issues, but I think the right to socialize online should also be seen maybe not as fundamental a right as some of the legal stuff we're talking about, but as a fundamental right for a couple of reasons. One, again, the correct analogy is the telephone. What kind of a society would we have if we told people, you know what, you have no right to privacy on your phone because Verizon owns the line? We don't do that because that would be a poorer society, and it would be a shame if that is what is happens on the Internet. The second thing is, with a site like Facebook, they have been built, and they are making money all from the participation of their users. I mean, it is the work that, you know, 500 million have put in that have made Facebook into what it is today. That's what made, you know, them so rich. And I'm glad they've made the money, but I think they owe, at least at a moral and ethical level, all those people who have put in all that work to make that site work, a reasonable and understandable privacy policy that matches the intuition of what they are doing there, what people are expecting to do. The third thing I want to say is that a site like Facebook benefits enormously from what we call network effects or network externalities, in that you go there because that's where all your friends are. I mean, I can go to you can create an alternative social network site, and I'll go there, and if none of my friends are there, it's useless to me. It's kind of like having your own phone that nobody can call. So once they are like that, they're quasi-monopoly on a college campus. Basically, you really don't exist if you are not on Facebook. It's a very rare situation. It's kind of like making a big social statement because people, that's how they socialize, and it's the norm. And you have to recognize that just telling people, oh, don't do that, it's kind of like telling them, well, don't make friends. But in a world where who we know is the key to learning, to growing, finding jobs, socializing, becoming a person, trying out different things, telling them not to socialize, I don't think that's right for the society. That's a good path for us to go just because they want to sell us a little more effectively. I mean, that seems like such a big price to pay for such a trivial little concern.
Sean?
Well, Facebook's entitled to make a profit somehow. And it's a business model that's been around for forever, and this isn't to defend obscuring privacy issues. But the publishing industry has used a model called controlled circulation for a very long time, where you fill out a survey and tell details about your personal life or your business in order to get a magazine for free. And that same model has been translated to the web. And that's why advertising has moved so quickly to the web, is because they're able to get such good demographic data about the people who are looking at advertisements. There's a price for using the service. If this was a paid service, if you paid to have Facebook, you could assume a certain level of privacy. If they said you had privacy, the big issue is whether Facebook is actually giving you the level of privacy they say they're giving you, and whether or not they're delivering a service in a way that gives you that line between total privacy and having to pay for it and being out in the wide open and having everything exposed.
Let me do this. We only have 2 minutes left, and I promised Jackie, one of our callers, she'd have a word. Probably can't get much of a word, but Jackie, have the final word.
Hello?
Hi, Jackie. We only have like a minute left, so I'm giving you the final word.
Okay, that's a lot of pressure, but I'm just calling as a person who did grow up in the digital age. I'm 27 years old, and I'm calling just to let you guys know that it's not only the boomers that are uncomfortable with what's going on with the social networking sites. I've been listening, and the stuff that you guys are talking about, collecting data, and I know for myself, if, you know, in the recession, I have an employer that goes and looks at my Facebook site and kind of judges me as a candidate for that job based upon my Facebook site. It's no longer just, you know, oh, big deal, don't use it. Like, you've got to have a Facebook. You've got to have, you know, you've got to be connected. There's different groups and actions that kind of formulate there, but at the same time, well, I don't want to be judged by all my friends on my Facebook.
Jackie, we're out of time, but I would love you to write to me at Steiner, S-T-E-I-N-E-R, at steinershow.org, M-A-R-C, and tell me that story, and we'll start the next show off with that. How's that?
Absolutely. No problem.
So I wish we had time. I want to hear what Jay Stanley has to say about that. We don't have time. Jay Stanley, Senior Program Analyst at ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Dr. Zainab Tufekci, always great to have you on the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sean Gallagher, good to see you back in the studio again.
Good to see you.
Folks, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. When you get your weekly fix of art, culture, food, drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green sustainable products. Up-to-date topic information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Mark Steiner's show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Richard Good, Daniel Gillespie, and Will Mason. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new interviews, get information on all of our topics and guests. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.